Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're jumping back in with another good episode for you tonight. We're going to be talking a little bit about the recent nasty cold weather we had and some of the emergency management issues that we touched upon in parts of the country during that event. And we'll get into that here in just a second. But of course, we have to first touch base with my co-host Sam Bradley. Sam, is it chilly out in Colorado right now?
You know, it's actually been really nice the last few days. It's been pushing up toward the 60s. However, that's all going to change tomorrow.
I have a question for the Colorado people on the phone before we get into the weather report. If you live or go to Colorado, do you get lessons on how to strangle a cougar? Because I saw that in the news today. A jogger got attacked by a mountain lion, and he, while it was latched onto his head, strangled it to death. So I just wondered if that was like something you guys got like taught along with your driver's license and stuff.
Kyle, I'll let you take that one.
Well, you know, I had this old scout master one time back in the scouting days, and we learned all kinds of hand-to-hand combat, self-defense stuff, but I can't say any cougar stuff. But or a mountain lion stuff. But that was, I think it just shows the people are willing to do what it takes to survive.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly what I thought about.
Down easy.
I thought about that. Overcome.
I think I saw that story fly by, but I didn't have time to actually read it. But that's weird.
Yeah.
But anyway, the weather's going to change here tomorrow. It's going to be like 13 during the day, and we're getting into a minus pattern at night. So I'm sure that makes Kyle happy, because that means there's probably more snow in the mountains, assuming we're getting precipitation. What about that, Kyle?
Well, Sam, yeah, we are right in between waves of snow coming in here to Colorado. We do have the big system rolling on in the southwestern U.S., which has dumped feet of snow and several inches of rain from the coast all the way up through the mountains in California. And now, looking ahead to things in Colorado, we got us about 6 inches here last night in the valley in Aspen, and we got another big round on the way, followed by those cold temps that you're talking about on the Front Range.
Yes, I think we might even get a little snow down here. And we also have our Becky DePodwin. I'm lucky to have them both here tonight, since this is a weather-centric podcast. Hi, Beck.
Hey, Sam. Sorry to hear about your negative temperatures coming up. Can relate how not fun that is.
Well, given what's happening everywhere else in the country, I don't feel too bad. This is tolerable.
Yes, your turn now.
So what's it like in Pennsylvania?
Actually, it's been absolutely wonderful the last 2 days, even Sunday, but definitely Monday and today we're close to 60. So it was pretty balmy. I'm walking around without a jacket, shorts practically. But before that, it was definitely very, very, very cold. But I love the cold, so it doesn't bother me.
Coming back to Colorado. Jamie, how much of this did you get in Baltimore?
Oh, it was pretty cold, but we stocked up, made sure the wood pile in the garage was filled up and stuff, so we had plenty of dry wood, and we kept the fire running during the day and kept the house kind of toasty, and that the parts we stay in most of the time. So it was all right. You know, the biggest issue was making sure the dogs weren't staying out too long when we let them out, and they didn't want to, so that was okay. But, my daughter's dog has got a little bit more resilience for, the cold with his coat and stuff. So he would take off down into the yard, and my wife's dog wanted to go down and play with the big dog and, you know, came back freezing. So that was our biggest issue, was keeping the pets from, you know, getting too cold and being out too long.
For real. In some cases, they put little booties on them, like in Alaska. So, Joe, down there in Memphis, we wouldn't expect to see a lot of this, but I heard there was a hurricane, or not a hurricane, but a tornado in Alabama. Did you hear about that?
I did hear about that. We've had absolutely spectacular weather here, just a little bit of rain and nice springtime temperatures, honestly. So quite a bit warmer than I would anticipate for this time of year.
Well, it is kind of interesting, the variation in temperature across the country. It's a little bit odd. But I want to talk, which of you two wants to address California? Because they've been, I knew they had a lot of rain there after all this drought, but I mean, they've actually had 6 fatalities there. What do you guys know about that? Kyle, you want to take that?
Sure, Sam. I'll jump in here. Becky, feel free to round out. As you mentioned, Sam, California has been under the gun, so to speak, for some pretty nasty winter storm impacts. And when we're talking winter storms, the way that people experience impacts based on where you are, both geographically and in elevation and all that, it can vary quite widely, all the way from coastal flooding and torrential rains and flash flooding due to heavy rains impacting burn scar areas from all those devastating wildfires in California we talked about this past summer and fall. Now you put rain on top of that and it just runs off, and they actually had to evacuate several communities both preemptively and while things were evolving with this most recent event. In addition, as you get up into the mountains on the east side of the state in California, just absolutely insane snowfall totals being reported up there by some ski areas. They're having to actually dig out and snowcat under the chairlifts in some places so that there's actually enough clearance between the chairs and the snow below in order to get those resorts back open. But of course, with any storm, winter storm also comes some high winds. And with the torrential rains, it brought down several trees, power lines, which knocked out power to thousands of people. And as you mentioned, Sam, also resulted in several fatalities, both from motor vehicle collisions, as well as, I believe, I want to say there might have been one that was carbon monoxide related, but I'm not 100% sure on that. More recently, in the second wave that came through, a Ventura County search and rescue member was actually struck and killed when responding to a motor vehicle crash on the interstate, and there were other search and rescue members involved. They are expected to pull through, but unfortunately, one responder fatality in that case. So just goes to show that even with all of the technology and the tools that we have, inattentive driving is still killing our responders, and we should be more diligent in enforcing that and speaking up if someone in a vehicle that we're riding in is not paying
attention. Oh my. Yeah, that's awful when we lose one of our own. I know Joe can relate to that. But speaking of snow like that, as coming from a ski patrol perspective, what do you do when that snow's so deep that people, I mean, unless they're experts, couldn't even ski in it?
Well, from that perspective, Sam, it becomes a real logistical and operational challenge within the resorts. We've had those cases here in Colorado, as well as in the big mountain areas as well. And when you receive that much snow in so little time, it becomes a major hazard. So not only does it affect the ability of the local and state highway operators to clear the roads up to the resorts, much less to clear the parking lots and clear the buildings so that employees can access them, it's making sure the buildings are structurally sound with those accumulations of snow. In California, it's a very heavy, wet snow as compared to a very fluffy, lighter snow in the central Rockies, like Colorado, Utah, and up into northern Montana as well. Right, you have all that moisture, and so it's like cement. It sets up, and so you also can quickly build an avalanche hazard within bounds. And so that requires a ski patrol to get up there either with helicopters or actually putting themselves out there and to throw hand charges to mitigate the avalanche hazard in bounds, digging out the ski lifts, making sure things are ready to go, because in some areas on the flatter runs, the snow might be so deep that you can't even move on some of the flatter areas. So it's an all hands on deck effort with that much snow.
You know, I'm drawn to, you know, the fact that, you know, with all this weather, that, you know, the extreme weather in California with the extra precipitation, last week's polar vortex and things like that, that, you know, it's just we're looking forward to more and more volatile weather as you know, the climate adjustment happens, whether you want to call it climate change, global warming, whatever. But we are seeing more volatile weather patterns. Isn't that correct, Becky?
Yeah, even Seattle in the Pacific Northwest got in on the snow action. Seattle usually averages, about 7 inches of snow for 1 year. And they received 2 to 4, with some parts receiving 4 to 8 inches from this snow event. So certainly an unusual event for Seattle and for some parts of the Pacific Northwest. It's always fascinating to me to see snow that close to the coast. And I know there were a lot of issues on the roads. Washington DOT was, you know, having a hard time keeping the roads clear. So that's just another kind of more unusual aspect. Lots of power outages, lots of snow and ice. I saw one National Weather Service employee was going to have a hard time getting to work because everything was just totally iced over. You know, it's just not something they're used to really handling on a regular basis. Not to say they aren't equipped, but, you know, it's just not as common up there.
While we have you on, Becky, you want to talk a little bit about some of the things that happened last week with the extreme cold, talking about being prepared. Some of those communities are prepared for extreme cold, but maybe not that extreme. What do you know about what some of the things were going on in the upper Midwest?
Yeah, so the upper Midwest, it was certainly extremely cold. A lot of records tied some sets. Some new records were set. I don't think it was actually the coldest that it's ever been up there, certainly in some locations. It looks like I could throw out all sorts of locations that did break records. But I do think, you know, places like Minnesota, Illinois, Wisconsin, I think they're fairly well equipped and prepared to handle this. I know they canceled schools. I saw that one lady in Chicago actually paid for the rooms of about 80 homeless people, which I think is fantastic. So that's just sort of like a human aspect in all of this. But certainly a lot of temperature records set. You know, we were seeing wind chill values close to minus 75, I think, in certain locations, you know, pretty early in the morning. So, and also you had the wind, and then the lake effect snow as well. So not only, you know, it wasn't just the temperatures, but it was also the wind that really added insult to injury with this cold, and obviously made it feel a lot colder. And I would just like to point out that the wind chill is not made up. The wind chill is a real thing. It's a real factor of how, you know, how the wind feels to the human skin. So just to settle that rumor.
Sam, are you back with us?
I am.
Awesome. We lost you there for a second, but yeah, Becky was just kind of going over what happened with the polar vortex last week and the extreme cold. I maybe it's a good time to kind of talk to Joe a little bit about, you know, the extreme cold and its effect on the physiology. I think they were talking about things like not taking deep breaths because of the fact that you could, I don't know, freeze your lungs.
Well, and I remember the point that we made last week that we had heard that, you know, in those kind of temperatures, you can become frostbitten in 5 minutes. What can you tell us about that kind of cold, Joe, and its effect on humans?
Joe, are you still muted or did we lose you?
Oh, sorry. There is that mute button.
I hate that button. I love you, Joe.
I hate that button. Anyway, so the issue is, you know, such intensity of cold, especially with, you know, wind blowing and that sort of stuff, which really enhances the effects of extreme cold. All those things occur much more quickly than we are sort of used to and think about when we're out. So, you know, you've seen folks that take the pot of water outside and throw it up in the air and it freezes before it hits the ground. And you know, that's going to be very similar to what we're going to see from a, you know, the human body standpoint. The moisture on the skin is going to freeze very quickly. The moisture in the air and in our lungs will freeze very quickly. So, you know, paying attention to the wind chill there becomes important just because it so enhances the speed with which, you know, all this stuff is occurring. So,
You know, I think that one of the questions I had, because I saw several images of fires, obviously people trying to keep themselves warm were doing lots of things to keep to do that. And in some cases, you know, house fires started from chimney fires and things like that. And thinking of the firefighters and first responders that had to go out into that extreme cold and put a fire out. Now, obviously, when they're up close to the building and the structure is fully involved, that's going to warm them some. But, you know, you'd see these images of firefighters just encrusted in ice. And that's got to have an extreme effect as well on anyone doing any kind of physical work, too. Isn't that correct, Joe?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, we see this sometimes with you know, initially they get exposed to that cold and they literally do get encrusted in ice, which provides a little bit of protection, actually, from additional wind. It's an impermeable layer to some extent. But, you know, then as soon as they begin to warm up and get in a slightly warmer environment, as they get closer to the fire, that begins to melt. And now they have wet clothing on and they've lost that protective sheen that the film of ice provided briefly while they were in that sort of more temperate zone. So now they're wet, you know, continuously being exposed to those temperatures, and that certainly enhances their opportunities for severe cold injury related to that exposure that occurs much more quickly than it might otherwise.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. So I hope I didn't miss this, but Kyle, I have to know what a frost quake is.
Yes, Sam. So frost quakes, also known as cryoseisms, if you really want to get nerdy with it. So essentially, it's a cold earthquake or an earthquake caused by extremely cold temperatures. So how this actually sets up, and it's most commonly seen in the Midwest and in the Great Plains, where during very, very cold outbreaks where temperatures fall very rapidly, from above freezing to below freezing, the water that's naturally in the soil and rock beneath the surface will freeze and expand as it becomes frozen. You know, think of putting that, you know, if you leave a can of Coke or, you know, like in your car, or if you put your beer outside to chill and it becomes frozen, God forbid, that's kind of what we're talking about. So think of the water in the soil as that expands, as it freezes, it's pushing against all the other the soils and the rocks around it. And eventually that energy has to become released once that the rock and soil can no longer hold that energy together. And it's released very violently. And you hear that as an explosion that sounds like an earthquake coming from the ground. And so that's actually a frost quake.
That's just a little too weird. Jamie, you had a thought on that.
Well, and it's interesting because as you explained that, we have actually any time it gets down in the single digits here at my house, we have a wooden deck out to the rear of our home. And at night when it gets really super cold, I think moisture in the wood does the same thing. And you'll just hear like this pop that'll, you know, sound like a gunshot right behind the house. And it'll be like, you know, there might be several of those an hour over the very early morning hours. The first time it happened, you know, when we were first moved in years back, I searched the whole house to try to find out where these noises were coming from before I realized it was the wood on the deck that was popping because of the cold. But it's kind of weird when you don't know what you're listening to first.
Oh, I can imagine so. I had a question for Becky. Where did it go? Oh, yeah. I heard, you know, you were mentioning wood. There was something about Chicago. They were burning railroad tracks. So I guess the issue is the heat from the fire keeps the metal from contracting, causing fractures in the tracks, but it prevents the switches from freezing and the bolts from coming out. Oh, my God. That's a little scary that could happen. So it seems like transportation in general can really be halted. Becky, maybe you can comment on, you know, when you got the Great Lakes freezing and these major rivers, that's got to wreak some havoc.
Um, I'm not quite sure what you mean in terms of like transportation on the rivers or.
Yeah, well, I would think, you know, the rivers carry a lot of product in and out of an area. And if they're not used to having it freezing, and these aren't boats that are used to dealing with ice.
Actually, funnily enough, that's not a word, funnily is the word. Anyway, I actually know tangentially a captain of a boat that peruses lakes, I think both Lake Superior and Lake Michigan. And he posts the most incredible videos on Instagram of his ship actually moving through the ice. So there is a certain point on, I think most of the Great Lakes, at least, I'm not sure about rivers, but most of the lakes, when they're starting to freeze, that they're actually still passable if you have the right kind of boat that is able to kind of push through that first layer of ice. Obviously, after a certain point, transportation on the Great Lakes is very difficult, although it does take a lot for some of the lakes to freeze completely because they are so deep. I know one of the lakes isn't even frozen at all. I just saw this. But then, of course, you also have the instance of lake effect snow. So if we had been fairly mild leading up to this most recent cold snap. And so the lakes hadn't frozen yet. And then you get this extremely cold air pushing in, which caused a really intense lake effect band to set up over Lake Erie and impact the Tug Hill, no, sorry, Lake Ontario, and impact the Tug Hill Plateau up in western New York. So they saw just an intense amount of snowfall over a 1 to 2 day period. Same with the Buffalo region from a lake effect band on Lake Erie. So from that perspective, even areas that are around bodies of water can definitely be really, really impacted. I think as far as rivers, as long as the river is moving swiftly enough, it'll have a harder time fully freezing. But some rivers certainly can freeze over, and that ultimately ends boat transport for that region. But then, of course, I think some regions will have other, you know, just go over the ice.
Yeah, I think I saw in Chicago they were running small icebreakers up and down the river in central Chicago to keep that waterway open because they do have some barge traffic that comes down that way. Also, they did shut down train traffic in Chicago for about 24 hours at the height of the cold front because despite the fact that they were setting fire to the tracks in different places, they still had places where the tracks themselves warped because of the cold enough that they were no longer safe to carry traffic until the temperatures rose again. And just, you know, I think that the biggest thing is that it just has an overreaching effect on all systems, whether it's communication, transportation, emergency services, housing and things like that, public health. And, you know, unfortunately, numerous deaths from people from a variety of things. But most often it seems like a medical issue caused them to lose consciousness or become incapacitated. And then they died from a cold injury in what everything that I read, which is tragic, you know, when you think about it. But it's one of those things that we continue to tell people to check on your elderly neighbors and people that you think are in need in your community, because this is one of those situations, just like any disaster, where people become more have to be more self-reliant and start relying more on community resiliency than others. Kyle?
Yeah, I know we got to bounce you out of here in a few minutes, so I think you had some final thoughts.
Yeah, and with all the talk about winter weather and some of the impacts that we've touched on both last week as well as tonight, we've kind of hit on them individually, but I think it's also important to kind of reiterate that these are all linked. The effects of hazardous weather, the impacts that are received, and the both direct and indirect effects, both with the physical infrastructure and also the economic impacts on our communities. So think about something, just talk about cascading events. You have a dangerous cold outbreak. You have schools that close. Kids have to be at home. And if the parents can't find childcare, they may have to stay home as well. You know, now you have employees, even if they are deemed essential, may not be able to come in because they can't find childcare. That can have economic effects later on down the line in the community, as well as staffing issues, especially for our first response agencies, 911 telecommunication centers as well. Now you get into these melt freeze events, wind and snow, power outages. Just last night, one of our officers was driving down the highway and he's like, hey, there's a transformer on fire up on a power pole. And so 500 customers lost power last night for about 4 hours here just outside of Aspen. Now, and then you could also have, and several communities and states have even had natural gas and liquid propane shortages. Michigan had this during that big cold outbreak, forcing people to turn towards alternate, not always safe sources of heat. And people start to try to make fires in chimneys that maybe haven't been maintained. You get chimney fires and structure fires that result. You get carbon monoxide issues from people trying their best to restart that kerosene heater that they've had in their basement from their grandparents forever. And also, with all the snow and wind that comes in, it can often drift on the side of the house where the exhaust vents are for heating appliances. So now, just inadvertently, you might start feeling lightheaded. Well, that's because of a tool that you can't exhaust. So all of these kind of tying in together and ultimately resulting in a larger community impact that, you know, might begin with the first call from an alarm company at the 911 center, ultimately finding a family that is being affected by carbon monoxide and turning out that they did nothing wrong except just not clearing the vent from that heating appliance.
Oh, really good info, Kyle. And thanks for contributing to our conversation tonight. But, you know, you led me right into where I was going to go here at the end of the show. But, Becky, you know, you've been studying, in fact, I think you've finished your emergency management degree. So, you know, this is a big question, I realize. But, you know, what kinds of things does an emergency manager have to think about? Now, Kyle mentioned a number of them.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I think the one thing I'm going to hit on here is the whole community approach. When these things happen, it's important to know the resources that you have available to you. It's important to understand how your situation may evolve, whether that's, you know, taking care of your house, making sure that your pipes aren't going to freeze, making sure, like Kyle said, like your chimney and fireplace is in working order, making sure that your neighbors around you are taken care of. Just even things like knowing how the snow removal works in your area is helpful. And if you have questions, you can always contact the township, the local emergency manager. I know the township that we live in here in Pennsylvania is really good about sending out updates and keeping the residents informed about snow removal and anything else that we need to know. But in terms of like what the emergency manager themselves need to do, it's really making those connections beforehand and working with, you know, local store owners, local businesses, maybe hotels, if they know that there are people who are going to need to stay somewhere else. So just it's really doing a lot of preparation ahead of time and being in tune and in touch with your community to have a full and complete understanding of what the needs are going to be, whether it's cold, whether it's heat or severe weather or anything like that. Just, you know, knowing how you're going to react should any situation occur.
And I'm sure that there is emergency plans for different contingencies like cold weather, hot weather, hurricanes, tornadoes, all that kind of thing, the things that they expect in a specific area. So,
yeah, you certainly have to understand the risks that you're facing in your area.
And agencies should be talking with each other on who's going to play what part, you know, in the mitigation of these things. Correct?
Yes. Yep, definitely. Working with, you know, whatever resources you have, the National Weather Service to get an update, you know, the local DOTs, FEMA, should it come to that, you know, all levels of emergency management.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's funny, Jamie, because every time we think we've seen a worst case scenario, another one comes along that's even worse. And I think this cold thing was one of those. So we're always learning about the worst case scenario, because it just, it's like those 500-year storms that come every couple months. What are you going to do? You just got to keep on learning how to prepare yourself.
Absolutely. And you know, that preparation comes from training and really knowing, as you said, what to expect in your given community. And it occurred to me, you know, the different ways that Joe and the people at Paragon Medical Education Group do their specific types of different training. And I have to wonder, Joe, do you guys ever like involve cold weather in your training programs and training evolutions? Because I imagine doing like a search and rescue drill wearing heavy cold weather gear is a lot different than what you'd wear, say, down in Florida following a hurricane.
Well, there's no question about it. You know, the extremes of temperature especially are really challenging when it comes to personal protective equipment and, you know, confined space and the challenges of doing search and rescue. So, yes, we do incorporate those aspects into it because it's a completely different set of problems if you're dealing with cold similar to what we've been talking about versus intense heat that you'd find on the Gulf Coast in September or August or something like that.
So, you know, and that just goes to talk about the customizable nature of what you guys put together. And so if somebody wants to kind of reach out to you all, and I recommend doing this, by the way, reaching out and saying, this is my set of problems in my community. This is what I want to train for. What can you do? Where can they reach you to do that?
Oh, well, you can certainly reach us through the interwebs at paragonmedicalgroup.com or through our Facebook page by the same name or through the Disaster Podcast.
Great. And I hope people will do that because really I honestly believe they can't go wrong bringing in that kind of customized experience. And that's what will make the difference when you have that event, that major event that is the life-changing event for your community. So we want to make sure you're prepared for that. Kyle, I think you're still with us. Before you head out, do you want to share your own contact information with us and let us know how people can get a hold of you?
Absolutely. Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to connect with me there. Also in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, I'm always happy to continue the conversation.
Thanks, Kyle, and have a good night on shift tonight. We'll catch up with you next time.
Looking forward to it.
Becky, how about you? Where can folks best reach out to you if they have any questions about weather-related issues or emergency management issues that they'd like to kind of discuss with you?
Yeah, Twitter is definitely the best place for that. I'm WX_Bex, or you can search Bex Depot is where I'm at now. I'm also definitely in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, and I'm happy to have conversations on any variety of topic that comes up there. And I enjoy seeing the posts and articles that people are putting in there. I'm learning a lot just following along, too.
Great. And it's always great to have you participate. Thanks for continuing to be a member of the team here. We really appreciate having you.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
Sam, how about you?
Well, Becky's the Twitter queen. I'm not nearly as active in Twitter, but I'm there and in the other social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And I love the Facebook group. We've been getting such good information from our community, which is growing fast. We're like in excess of 650 now, I think, and growing. So that's an awesome place to be. And certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. So please friend or follow me over in those places. And as we said already, the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, which we were over 650, but then Facebook changed the way they manage their groups. And they purged a bunch of people from all of the groups out there. So we actually dropped back down below 600, which is still a great number of people. And the people they dropped off the group were people that weren't actively participating in any way anyway. But if you find yourself removed from the group and are listening to this podcast, please just go ahead and request to join again. That's all it takes. And we'd be happy to have you back in. We didn't kick you out. Facebook did. So please rejoin the group and rejoin the conversation. You know, Stan, talking about the cold weather, and as we have been a lot for the last couple of years, all the weather-related events that have caused severe situations in managing emergencies, it brings us around to facing unique sets of issues in each one.
It does, and strangely, if it wasn't for that kind of weather, Joe and I wouldn't have jobs with the federal government. So, you know, it is what it is. But clearly, disaster weather is not our everyday weather.